Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Seems to be suffering from diplomatic whiplash. On one hand, members of a House committee voted yesterday to block the deal handing operations of six major U.S. ports to a Dubai-owned company. And GOP leaders are reportedly telling the president today that the Senate will reject that deal as well. On the other hand, the State Department announced yesterday that Dubai will be the new home of a miniature embassy in exile set up to help defeat the Iranian regime. The announcement of this new office was made yesterday by Undersecretary of State Nicholas Burns, speaking before Congress, and joining us with more is Farah Stockman, foreign affairs correspondent for the Boston Globe. Farah, the U.S. doesn't usually go around announcing that it's setting up an office of regime change. How significant is this?
I think it's very significant. They don't call it the Office of Regime Change, but if you look closely at what they're really doing, that is the goal. I mean, I think what they're trying to do is really support Iranian exiles who are living in the UAE and in other places to overthrow their own government.
We understand almost 500,000 Iranian exiles live in Dubai, but there are some organized Iranian opposition groups, one called the MEK, and the supporters of the former Shah, and they've been actively working to overthrow the current government of Iran, and it's been reported that these groups felt that they thought they had inroads with the U.S. government. Is it significant that the U.S. seems not to be supporting them, but instead is choosing to set up shop with these less organized groups out of Dubai?
I think it's very interesting. I mean, Burns told Congress yesterday, well, we're going to be doing this on Iran's doorstep. We're going to be in the region. He was mentioning that this is the first time that they're going to station so many people in the Middle East who are focused solely on Iran, and so I think that that's a big deal. There are Iranian exiles in the United States, known as the MEK, who have a lot of support in Congress, despite the fact that they are currently listed on the terrorism list. And there's a lot of powerful people on Capitol Hill who would like to see them taken off the terrorist list and would like to see them supported with money or arms, similar to what happened in Iraq. And it doesn't look like the administration is going that route. It looks like they are trying to find people who might be closer, but might be in closer touch with what Iranians in Iran are thinking. Some of the people in the UAE are students who are simply studying abroad and plan to go back. There are about 10,000 Iranian students studying in the UAE.
The State Department announced other efforts as well, increasing the number of diplomats in Dubai that monitor Iran, opening Iran-specific posts in Istanbul, Frankfurt, moving the Iran specialists in the State Department in Washington to their own office and sort of beefing that up. What is the overall sentiment of what's happening, what they're supposed to do?
Well, I think that this is all part of the effort of the administration to really try to support Iranian opposition groups, and it's a big conundrum for them because how do you support Iranian opposition groups when you don't have contacts with them? They're not allowed to accept U.S. money. The administration has set aside $85 million. Or they want to set aside $85 million for these groups, and they, frankly, they can't find groups to take the money because that could mean a jail sentence for them, that could mean, or worse. And so I think part of the job of these new diplomats who are being stationed in Dubai and around the world is to basically find these groups, to seek them out, and to make more inroads with Iranian trade unions or other types of political organizations that we can give money to so that hopefully it could result someday in regime change. I think that's their plan.
Reflecting, as you and others have reported, that Iran is a country that the U.S. cut off relations with in 1979 after the hostage taking, and there really isn't good intelligence in that area. Farrell, one last question. I know you're not reporting on the Dubai ports deal, but I'm wondering if you think that the State Department efforts to set up an office in Dubai might be thwarted or hampered if Dubai is upset about the fact that U.S. lawmakers are trying to stop the ports deal.
Well, I suspect that the administration is taking the UAE aside and apologizing for Congress and telling them, look, this is an internal political problem that we're dealing with in the United States, but you guys should continue your cooperation with us. I suspect there's a lot of meetings going on like that which are trying to make the UAE feel comfortable again with cooperating with the Bush administration.
Farah Stockman, the foreign affairs correspondent with the Boston Globe, speaking to us from Washington. Farah, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, today the Senate Appropriations Committee is debating the Bush administration request for $91 billion to fight wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Meanwhile, a commission is asking, is the National Guard properly equipped to fight both those wars and respond to disasters here at home? And should its mission be to do both? The newly formed independent commission this week began a year-long review of the National Guard. Commission Chair Arnold Punaro told C-SPAN that Congress has recognized that there has been a profound change in how the National Guard is being used.
We've gone from the concept of the National Guard and Reserve, which provides a substantial part of our military force, from being a strategic reserve, that is a force that was trained and equipped perhaps for unlikely contingencies of World War III in Europe or a major contingency in North Korea. That has shifted over time to an operational reserve, where those Guard and Reserve forces need to be ready and are called up and are used each and every day.
The chief of the National Guard Bureau, Lieutenant General Stephen Blum, recently told reporters he has less than 34% of the equipment he's supposed to have here in the U.S., and some troops are driving trucks the U.S. wouldn't give to the Iraqi army. Well, General Blum joins us now on the line. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Robin.
And what does the commissioner's or the chair of the commission's statement mean to you, changing from a strategic reserve to an operational force?
Well, it means to me that they recognize the dramatic change that the National Guard has undergone in the last 5 or 6 years. Prior to September 11th, 2001, most people in our nation regarded the National Guard as a strategic reserve, which was going to be built and filled out, manned and equipped and trained over a long period of time and enter the late innings of perhaps a huge world conflict such as World War III. But we would not be the first troops in. We'd be there much later in the campaign, and it would take a lot of time to man the force, train the force, and equip the force, and we would be training and fighting against linear formations like the old Soviet Union,
exactly.
And we'd be filled up by a draft that hasn't existed in 34 years.
Right.
So they see that we're not that, and that we have to become the modern 21st century Minutemen and women, going back to our roots, able to transition from citizens to soldiers in a moment's notice.
This has been particularly a big change for people who enlisted, who really thought that they were going to be, you know, as we've heard, weekend warriors, perhaps pay their way through college, but not really see action.
No, that's fair and accurate. People used to join the National Guard with a different expectation of service and coming in either for college benefits or for adventure or to continue their service part-time and because they left a full-time military career early. That is no longer the case. We are an operational force of volunteers, a recruited force. We get called often with no or limited notice, especially here at home. We could be called to respond in minutes or hours, such as happened with Hurricane Katrina, Rita and Wilma, and hundreds of other responses to natural disasters around the country over the years. We could be deployed anytime, anywhere, such as we have. We've had up to 80,000 of our citizen soldiers and airmen operating in Iraq and Afghanistan, the Horn of Africa, Bosnia, Kosovo, Sinai. These are all unheard of missions from using the old paradigm.
Right.
They are today's modern reality.
Well, in fact, General, at one point, almost half the troops in Iraq were Guard troops, and they're being, you know, redeployed. How big a strain are these deployments, sometimes two or three tours, on the Guard?
Well, they're tough on the service member.
Right.
They're tougher on the families, and they're tougher on the employers, frankly. The civilian employers are full partners, as are our family members, with our Guard citizen soldiers and airmen. The soldiers adapt to it better than the families and the employers. So the way that you keep all three legs of that three-legged stool strong and solid, or we have to give our citizen soldiers some predictability on when they'll be deployed and for how long and when they'll return, because they have a partnership, a full partner in with their full-time employer back here at home, the mm-hmm. civilian employer, and their families. And we've done a much, much better job of that recently than we did in the early stages of this.
In fact, General, I wanted to ask, the commission is going to be looking at this for a year, but any thoughts on how there might be some new structure here, thinking of employers, for instance, who some of them sweating it out when, you know, employees who are in the Guard are overseas instead of, you know, stocking the aisles, for instance. Is there any sense of any kind of compensation, any, you know, any drastic rejiggering of the relationship?
Well, there's nothing that I can do there yeah. except that we're working with Congress. There are members of Congress that are very, very interested in providing incentives or rewards. Our big challenge are the self-employed and those that work in smaller numbered companies, such as an IT company that only has perhaps 6 or 8 employees. If 2 of them are mobilized, it's very significant. If you work for a large corporation that has several thousand employees and only a couple dozen are employed, deployed, it is far easier to deal with. So one size does not fit all, and we're working very hard to accommodate these great patriotic partners in the defense of our nation, America's employers.
Right. What about recruitment, given that, again, the sense of what a Guards person does has so changed? Do you have people, you know, not signing up? Are you meeting your goals?
Well, that's a good question. You would think that those who that had deployed would not stay with us, and you would think that recruiting would be more difficult under today's very strenuous conditions or requirements of service. And in fact, the exact opposite is the fact. Our retention rate or our ability to reenlist our citizen soldiers is at an all-time high. We're presently at about 103.4% of our goal for retention, and our recruiting is about 112% of our goal. We've had the last 5 months have been our best recruiting months in 13 years.
Well, now you mentioned something. I just want to, the recruitment is one thing, but we'd heard that retention was low.
Not in the National Guard, but maybe in some other places. But in the Guard, our retention rate is higher now than it was, significantly higher now than it was prior to 9/11.
Well, that's the people part. Let's take a look at some other aspects and stay with Iraq for a second. What about equipment? Much has been written in the past 3 years about National Guard troops going to Iraq without the proper equipment, again, because it wasn't thought they'd need to be there. Not enough body armor, for instance.
In the beginning, what you just said is an absolute fact. It was an intolerable condition that was not allowed to exist. The Army leadership and the Department of Defense leadership put enormous resources into making sure that no soldier went in harm's way, whether they were active, Guard, or Reserve, without the finest equipment we could put on the backs of these soldiers. It did not happen on day one, but when you go to Iraq or Afghanistan today, you cannot tell who is active, Guard, or Reserve by the uniform or the equipment or the weapons they're carrying or the way they perform their duty. It is magnificent, seamless. It is truly one army.
That's Chief of the National Guard Bureau, Lieutenant General Stephen Blum. But he'll be back in a moment to talk about equipment shortfalls in this country with about $3 billion worth of Guard equipment over in Iraq. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. Bureau, Lieutenant General Stephen Blum. A new commission chartered by Congress is holding day two of hearings today to examine the future of the Guard at a time when it's stretched thin, fighting wars abroad and responding to disasters here at home. And General Blum, you were saying that gone are the days of Guard soldiers not having adequate truck or body armor in Iraq. They now have comparable equipment to active duty soldiers. But recently, National Guard Logistics Officer Major Frank Holder said Guard equipment in Iraq is being worn out, blown up, or lent to U.S. or Iraqi forces, which begs the question, what's the state of Guard equipment here in the U.S.?
Everything that I just said about overseas is absolutely a great news story and true. I wish it were the same back here at home, but it is not, because of exactly the things that you just mentioned and because of the fact that we cross-leveled equipment from every unit that had the very best equipment to give to the unit that was going overseas, where it was either left in theater or worn out or destroyed, has left us under-equipped back here at home far less than I would find an acceptable level, and I am working with the Army and the Congress right now to make sure that we rectify that situation as fast as we possibly can, because as you saw in Hurricane Katrina, you need the most modern and capable equipment to respond to natural disasters or a terrorist event here at home, as well as having the same kind of capabilities overseas.
Well, let's talk about that home deployment, because, you know, staying with equipment, we understand one of the problems was the guardsmen couldn't communicate with each other because their state-of-the-art satellite phones were left behind in Iraq.
Well, that's exactly right. That's a perfect case in point. So what we have now done is we've made the Department of Defense and Department of Army and Air Force and the Congress quite aware of what we do not have back here at home, and the Congress is very much supportive of the Army and Air Force and the Department of Defense's effort to ensure that the equipment that is needed when the National Guard is called out by the governors or the president here back at home are just as capable as when we're called to active duty overseas.
This isn't just you talking, you know, the guy who would want everything top-notch for his troops, but we understand the governors have complained and are concerned. What are some of the concerns?
Well, the same concerns. If they have, for instance, let me give you an example. If the governor has an engineer unit that has bulldozers and graders and dump trucks, and they left them in Iraq, and the troops come home, and a hurricane hits, or a blizzard would occur, or mudslides, or flooding would occur, that engineer unit is very, very important to the governors. But they're only important and capable when you have people, the training, and the equipment. An engineer unit without bulldozers, graders, loaders, and dump trucks is not very capable to do any of the things that I just mentioned. Mm-hmm. So the governors are rightfully concerned that the units that they have back here at home are not only superbly trained and great people, but they have to have the equipment in their hands to deliver the capabilities the governor needs in time of need.
Well, but the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Homeland Security, Paul McHale, recently said the Department of Defense shouldn't overreact to cries of equipment shortfalls from the Guard. And Congress has approved about $23 billion, much of it for equipment for the Guard. What do you say in response to that?
The $23 billion will go a long way to accomplishing what I just described. Is that the totality of it? No, it isn't. But it will take several budget cycles to get us well. And probably by the time it's done, it will probably be double that number. We're not going to make every single unit well overnight, but I do need to put the right capabilities and the right force mix in at least every region of our country so that when a governor calls out the Guard, they call out the kind of capabilities that that Guard unit really should expect to have. And that translates largely into, do they have the right equipment that we need to do the job?
Well, and General Blum, there's the overarching question. Is this the right mission? I mean, do you think the Guard is capable of being, as it's now called, a real fighting force and a domestic force? Can it really respond to disasters and fight a war?
Oh, yeah. You do not want a National Guard that is strictly the home guard. You do not want a National Guard that strictly can only fight a hurricane.
But I guess the question, sir, and I'm sorry to interrupt,
sure.
But I guess the question is, weren't they supposed to be reserves? And it sounds like there's nothing being reserved.
Well, that's an interesting way of looking at it. But only become an operational force overseas recently, and frankly, that is good, because this nation should never send its young sons and daughters to war without the American people behind them. And when you call out the Guard, you call out America. We're not being overused. If I thought we were, I would send a signal loud and clear that I felt the Guard was being overused.
But to the question of your concerns, given that you agree that the Guard can do both fight a war and be a domestic force as well to respond to disasters, make it clear to us, what do you think the country needs to do to make that happen best?
I think we have to rebalance the force to make sure that we have the right mix of units. I've got some heavy combat units that I probably need to change into engineer units and combat support units. And when we have that accomplished, I think we'll have an even better National Guard than we do right now.
Well, for instance, were there enough guards people to deploy in the aftermath of Katrina?
Oh, absolutely. I had 8,500 National Guardsmen in place when the hurricane hit. There were almost 80,000 people overseas out of the National Guard. The National Guard flowed 50,000 citizen soldiers and airmen into Mississippi and Louisiana in a little less than a week. I still, even then, had over 300,000 more that we could have called upon from the other states and territories to come in there.
But as you said, you feel there's a lot more that has to be done, money, equipment.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And a lot of it has to do with exactly what we discussed a little earlier about ensuring that the equipment back here at home has the same priority. I think the National Guard is prepared and is preparing each and every day. We take that extremely serious with an organization called the National Guard. If you're not going to guard the nation, you ought to get a new name for the title.
Lieutenant Stephen Blum, he is chief of the National Guard Bureau. Lieutenant, thank you. And tomorrow on Here and Now, the story of a freak storm more than 100 years ago in the plains. It's known as the Children's Blizzard. Why did so many freeze to death so fast? That's tomorrow. By the way, I called him Lieutenant. He is a general. Should salute him as well. More ahead Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. The museum
in Bush will sign the renewal of the USA Patriot Act later today. Major provisions in the law were set to expire tomorrow. The president is still battling the Democrats and members of his own party over his warrantless wiretapping program, while Republican leaders in Congress told the president today they intend to block the Dubai port deal. This dissension comes as the Republican Party faithful gather in Memphis for what one analyst is calling the first major cattle show before the 2008 elections, spring training for presidential candidates. Headliners at the Southern Republican Leadership Conference include Senators Bill Frist, John McCain, George Allen, and Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney. Chuck Dodd is editor-in-chief of The Hotline, the National Journal's daily briefing on politics. And Chuck, you're there in Memphis. Give us some context. How important really is this leadership conference for the wannabe Republican presidential candidate?
Well, what these conferences are mainly for as far as the ups and the downs, it's usually a place that sort of eliminates the people that fumble the ball, you know, eliminates the people that don't speak well, or you can really make a mistake at these things. You can't ever gain momentum, but you can certainly lose momentum.
Who are some of the names that are floating around that might be some of those lesser-known guys?
I think the lesser-known guys are guys like Sam Brownback, Senator from Kansas, Mike Huckabee, Governor from Arkansas. These are two guys in particular who don't have a lot of money, aren't seen to be the candidates that are going to be able to raise the $40 or $50 million that a lot of people think you're going to need to raise in order to be competitive. So it's a chance for them to see if they can get some traction.
Well, we read that Rudy Giuliani, who's always been a name in the past, is planning to buck tradition and not attend the conference. He, of course, the former mayor of New York City. What do you read into that?
Well, look, I've never thought of Giuliani as a likely candidate. I think he's an unlikely candidate. I think, you know, sure, is there a chance he might run? I think so, because he says there's a chance he might run. But he certainly acts like somebody who's not going to run. He's not been lining up major donors. He's not been doing the Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina circuit. Now, does he travel the country giving speeches? Absolutely. But he seems to be more interested in marketing his companies and making money than he is in gathering political chips.
His new security companies. Well,
yeah,
you know, I'm wondering, Chuck, if you think that this year the tone might be markedly different from years past. The Republican Party famously organized and falling in line behind President Bush in recent years. And this year, as we've been commenting on, for instance, it was Republicans who led the fight to stop the Dubai port deal. This happened yesterday, a real break from President Bush. Do you think that those breaks are going to sort of, I don't know, roil the waters a little bit at this meeting?
I don't think so. I mean, I think you'll hear a couple of speakers that might sound like they're somehow distancing themselves from President Bush. But I think for the most part, look, the people that are attending this leadership conference are probably some of President Bush's most ardent supporters. So this isn't the place to somehow start trashing the president and somehow trying to distance yourself from the president.
Really? You don't think there will be conversation about that Dubai deal in particular?
Might, absolutely. Will there be people that mention the ports deal? Sure. But you're not going to see it in a way that somehow creates tension between the candidate and the White House.
Well, I guess that begs the other question. What's going to be happening in the back rooms at this event?
Look, for guys like George Allen, Mitt Romney and Bill Frist, right? The three of them are seem to be the three guys that a lot of people think could become the chief challenger to John McCain. If you buy into the premise that John McCain's a frontrunner, which I think most people do, including the candidates running for president, then this is about gathering supporters among the sort of activist conservative community to try to become the chief alternative to McCain. So I think that that's what the background is going to be about, is does Romney find some supporters here? Does Frist able to reignite sort of himself as a national candidate after he had a very rough year in Congress? And does George Allen sort of continue being the guy that sort of everybody seems to be thinking, he's probably the most likely Bush-Reagan-type candidate that could challenge him?
It's funny, though. I'm wondering, and again, it goes back to, you know, what we were just talking about. Will these potential candidates try to present themselves as, you know, Bush types or not?
Well, look, I think, you know, this is what's so difficult when you're running for president and your party's in charge of the White House, right? I mean, we saw Al Gore have difficulties with this back in 2000. Mm-hmm. You want to look like you're an agent of change, but stable change. And so you got to find that line. You know, you got to find that line of you want to keep the stability of the Republican Party in place, but that you have a vision going forward to advance things that President Bush did. So mm-hmm. I think that that's the difficulty in this because, you know, we're a society that just loves change. Look, history tells us that it's incredibly difficult for political parties to win three presidential elections in a row. It doesn't happen very often. They're exceptions. They're not the rule. So this is always going, 2008 was always going to be an uphill battle for the Republicans simply because of history.
And this comes at a time when President Bush has his lowest poll ratings ever.
Right. Throw that in there and right. It becomes that much more difficult. I mean, at least Al Gore was running at a time when President Clinton was relatively popular.
Well, we hear that you're going to be administering a straw poll at this conference asking who will be the next Republican presidential candidate. Tell us a little bit about that poll and its past results.
It's a tradition at the Southern Republican Leadership Conference to have a straw poll, and they always try to get an outside organization to do it to give it some credibility. The people on our ballot are the invited speakers who are considered active presidential candidates. So, for instance, we don't have people like Condoleezza Rice or Jeb Bush on our ballot because we don't want, we want people to be considering people that are actually in the midst of running. And we're going to be asking people their first choice, and we're going to be asking them their second choice so that we have an idea who's popular and what group of candidates seems to be getting the most support. We're going to have John McCain's on the ballot, and he's speaking there Friday night. We've got George Allen, Sam Brownback, Bill Frist, Mike Huckabee, Mitt Romney, Chuck Hagel, the senator from Nebraska, and we are including Giuliani on this because he was invited, and he had, up until about a week ago, had not given a yes or a no, so he is going to be on the ballot, and it'll be interesting to see how much support he gets.
And just give me a sense, past ballots, how have they done?
Well, in 98, the Southern Republican Leadership Conference, a governor of Texas named George W. Bush won the thing. And it served as a pretty good precursor to letting people know. Of course, he didn't attend that year. That was interesting. Every other major candidate attended that year except him, because a year before, Bush had attended the Midwest Republican Leadership Conference, sort of a sister organization, and bombed. He was just awful, gave a speech that just was the sort of first time on the national stage, and he was just roundly criticized in the press by colleagues, this or that, so that all of a sudden the Bush people made the decision to sort of stay off the trail for about a year and didn't really get back on the trail until 99, and it obviously turned out to be a pretty smart move.
And cautionary, somebody could bomb in 2006 but show up, you know, blazing in 2007.
That's right. I mean, but that said, at the Southern Republican Leadership Conference in 98, a guy named Jack Kemp, who at the time was one of the two front runners, and people were saying, you know, God, it's going to be Kemp. He had just been the nominee for vice president, and his speech bombed. And that was sort of the start of the beginning of the end of Kemp's presidential ambition.
Chuck Todd, editor-in-chief of The Hotline, the National Journal's daily briefing on politics, speaking to us from Memphis, where he's attending the Southern Republican Leadership Conference, which begins today. Chuck, thanks so much.
You got it.
And you're listening to Here and Now. Well, Well, the layperson might not be able to tell the difference between a bovine patella and the bones of T. rex. The experts at the American Museum of Natural History in New York definitely can, or at least they can try. Each year, the museum holds what it calls ID Day, inviting the public to bring in their favorite backyard finds. The museum's scientists take a look, scratch their heads, and do their best to identify the found objects. And sometimes, the rookie paleontologist hits the jackpot. Producer Kate Hines went to the museum on ID Day this year and filed this report.
Tristan Dubin hoped that his unusual family heirloom might be of the Jurassic persuasion. To test his theory, the 10-year-old brought it to the Museum of Natural History's 16th annual ID Day, where museum scientists set up shop on folding tables in the Hall of Birds of the World.
I brought in this bone I found, my grandpa found when he was digging up my great-grandma's flower bed.
It quickly becomes apparent that the experts here today go beyond sharing their deductive reasoning skills with the public. They must also manage expectations. Paleontologist Carl Melling tries to break the news gently.
This is a modern bone, for sure. You see how flat this surface is? This has been cut by a bone saw, so I'm guessing it's a cow. I think it's too big to be a horse.
Melling's official guess? A cow's knee.
I thought it was a dinosaur ankle when I was a really little kid. I got really excited when my grandpa sent it to me.
That's exactly how I wound up here.
Tristan is sad, but able to maintain perspective.
I feel a bit depressed, but I still think it's pretty cool, though.
Melling explains that sometimes you have to slog through a lot of 20th century cow bones before you hit the jackpot.
For me, I get a lot of people's imaginations of what is a fossil, but one year, I think it was my second year, this family came by and dropped an object on the table and said, "We found this on the beach in Virginia, what is it?" And I freaked out because it was a fossil walrus skull. And they're pretty rare, especially, you know, on the East Coast, south of the Arctic Circle.
The skull, which is between 10,000 and 20,000 years old, was donated to the museum. In geologic time, that's practically 10 minutes ago, compared to the fossil found by a gentleman who would give his name only as Tom. He's clearly done his homework.
This is a small cobble that I found in Central Park that has fossil impressions. It's probably Devonian, about 400 million years old, but likely carried to Central Park by during the last ice age.
Jamie Newman is the manager of the museum's Gems and Minerals collection.
Everything you said sounded right to me, that you wouldn't find fossils like this in Central Park that originated there. Let me look carefully at this with my hand lens. See, it's like a brachiopod kind of thing?
Yes.
And a Devonian from upstate that was brought by the glacier.
Anthropologist Anibal Rodriguez is manning one of the most popular tables. He has seen a fair number of arrowheads already today, and before the day is out, he will likely see more. So when Jane and Jackie Morano bring in two of them, he's able to pass judgment quickly.
This one is real. I have a problem with this one.
He puts it aside.
I think this is a fake.
The type of thing you might find in a gift shop, and focuses on the one Jackie found underneath a tree in her backyard in Chatham, New Jersey. It's approximately 2,000 years old, from the early woodland Native American culture. Rodriguez turns it over in his hands and marvels at the find.
When you think about all the development and houses that are built and the dirt is churned by machinery, and you know, you think everything has been pulled out of the ground, and all of a sudden, bingo, you have an arrowhead. It's very interesting.
That is perhaps the greatest lesson of ID Day, that your next find might turn up where you least expect it. Just ask Neil Duncan, a collection specialist for the Division of Vertebrate Zoology.
Got a sperm whale tooth today. I guess the guy found it underneath the seat of his car when he bought it.
Oh, do not go to my sister's backyard. It's all pets. So sad. Our story on ID Day at the American Museum of Natural History in New York was produced by Kate Hines. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. his fate today. Gotti is accused of racketeering and ordering his thugs to beat up a vocal critic when Gotti was head of the Gambino crime family. Well, the trial is notable in that Gotti, through his lawyers, renounced his mob days and expressed a lot of soul-searching. Sound familiar? The Sopranos, the eagerly awaited saga of the conflicted New Jersey crime boss, returns this Sunday on HBO. The Sopranos join Scarface and The Godfather as fiction accused of leaving the impression that all Italian-Americans are connected in one vast crime conspiracy. George DiStefano is author of the new book, An Offer We Can't Refuse, The Mafia in the Mind of America. He joins us now. And George, I gather you'll be watching the new Sopranos, but like many Italian-Americans, with conflicted feelings?
I'll have mixed feelings if the show doesn't live up to its to its past standards. But I know what you're getting at, that for a number of Italian-Americans, the show is problematic. And it seems to me that reactions to it among Italian-Americans fall into one of three categories. They either outright hate it and regard it as pure defamation and a caricature of Italian-American culture, or else they just love it. They're just kind of total unabashed fans of the show. And some other people fall somewhere in between those poles. They like the show, but they also find it disturbing, and they see it as one more instance of people of their ethnicity as being represented in this very narrow sort of way, being represented basically as criminals or people associated with criminals.
You write that Italian Americans' association with organized crime is actually way on the decline. They've been replaced by more recent immigrant groups, such as Russians, for instance. But as columnist Clive Haberman writes, let's face it, no one's ever going to write a TV show called The Sopranoffs. Why is that? What is it about the mystique and increasingly, as you write, the myth of the Italian mobster?
I think it's, you know, we've had now decades of these representations of Italian Americans, and they've attained a certain amount of cultural weight. They feature cliches that people are familiar with, look forward to, and enjoy a lot, such as the food fetishism of these movies and the passion and the drama and the idea of whacking enemies, being able to take care of people who do you wrong. They get some kind of vicarious excitement and identification out of these stories.
Interestingly, you point out that many African Americans, hip-hop artists, embrace what they think is the reality of an American mafia through media.
And I think that speaks to a couple things, particularly sort of the class aspect of organized crime and of criminality. I talk in the book quite a bit about how the mafia, the what we know as the Sicilian mafia, was born in poverty and underdevelopment and a lack of civil order, and people didn't trust government and civic institutions.
This was in the south of Italy, where Sicilians were discriminated against by the northern Italians, began to come to America in droves in the late 1800s, and then faced discrimination again here.
Yes. And so I think for other groups who have had similar histories of discrimination and exclusion, cultural stereotyping, there's something very potent about this mafia myth.
Give us some examples of how hip-hoppers reference the mafia.
Well, I was surprised to find out just how many artists and producers use the name Gotti in some way. I think in one section of the book I have a list of about 8 or 10 different rap artists. Snoop Dogg's first album was called The Dog Father. Lil' Kim had an album 2 albums ago called Bella Mafia, and she has a shout-out to Vittoria Gotti and the Gotti family.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I am the one and only Queen Bee. After me, there will be none. But you can call me Miss White. Most people know me as Little Kim, the head of the LaBella Mafia. Oh, shout out to my girl Victoria Gotti, the whole Gotti family. Stay up.
And clearly, the movies like Goodfellas and The Godfather, as well as Brian De Palma's Cubanized remake of Scarface, they all had a strong influence on gangster rap.
Hmm. And yet, at one time, as we were saying, this is a community of people, the largest immigration to America I think, ever, right, was the Italian-Americans around the turn of the century.
Mm-hmm.
And they were accused of bringing fleas. 11 Italian men were lynched in New Orleans, the biggest lynching in American history.
It's quite amazing to read some of these accounts from that era when immigration was at its peak to see just how Italian-Americans were regarded.
In fact, I'm looking at an illustration from Life magazine in 1911. It's a cartoon. There's a man with a bowler hat, you know, a gentleman, sitting, having his shoes shined with some muscled, dark-haired, dark-eyed, he almost looks gorilla-like.
Simeon, yes,
yeah,
definitely.
Italian, and the caption underneath is a wop. And forgive what is such a pejorative, but in this context. And it reads, a pound of spaghetti and a red bandana, a stilet and a corduroy suit. Add garlic would make for him stronger the muscle and a talent for black of the boot.
It's pretty shocking, to a lot of people, just the frankly racist nature of so much that was said about Southern Italians at that time. And both by kind of what I call in the book the WASP nativists, Anglo-Saxons, but they took a lot of their cues from what was being written by Northern Italian social scientists who also saw Southern Italians as inferior and prone to crime just by nature.
Mm. And that stereotype, prone to violence, what is true? Was there a mafia in America?
No. Definitely there were Italian-American criminal gangs that rose up in America in the 20th century from Prohibition era on. But I think the consensus of most experts these days is that these organizations were pretty much independent, locally based. They might collaborate or cooperate on certain business matters of mutual interest. But the idea of a unified criminal conspiracy imported from Sicily, overseen by a commission, was more mythology than fact.
Let's talk about your personal experience, because you write that one of the things that this mythology did was overshadow other contributions that Italian-Americans made, including those of, let's say, one of your grandfathers who was a social activist.
Yes, that's true. That aspect is often forgotten. My maternal grandfather from Sicily was a guitarist, a classical musician who also appreciated jazz. He was a labor organizer, and that's often forgotten, not only that there were individuals like him, but they were part of a larger milieu of immigrants who were progressive, who were interested in social justice and reform, who had broad cultural interests. So there's a whole world that's rarely represented in popular culture, a whole world of Italian-American experience.
We're talking with George DeStefano, the author of An Offer We Can't Refuse, The Mafia and the Mind of America. And by the way, The Offer We Can't Refuse, it's of course one of those famous lines from The Godfather, but also something that you think applies to Americans.
Yes, I specifically picked that as the title, as An Offer We Can't Refuse. We keep coming back to these stories. They keep attracting our attention. We continue to be fascinated by them. The longevity of The Godfather is just amazing to me, that it's still extremely popular. And some people see Vito Corleone as being on the level of, say, Huck Finn as an archetypal character in American literature. So the we is certainly to implicate all of us, including myself, in the fascination with this pop culture genre and with this subject matter.
George DeStefano, author of An Offer We Can't Refuse, The Mafia in the Mind of America. George, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for all the breaking news and these stories here and now.